And then I guess I want to, without further ado, I want to introduce our speakers. We have Gary, Barry, and Nikki, all from Rice University, who are going to be talking to us today about their ITEL at Rice University. So please join me in welcoming our speakers from Rice University.
I am Gary from the panel, and my role is Sir Service and Problem Master. Nikki is the Service Sister and Grand Diva of the Service Desk. Barry is Event Wrangler and Kernel of Change. So for those of you familiar with a little bit of ITEL, you'll know that those are roles we've chosen or been assigned to do, to be able to maneuver aspects of management of service, change, problems, incidents, requests for service forward. So instead of introducing by titles, I thought it would be more appropriate to talk about roles. And you'll see that as we make our presentation today. A little bit about Rice, because that's an important aspect for you to understand the culture in which we're doing the work that we're doing. We're a private institution, a research university in Houston. So what we want to share with you today is a little bit about Rice culture, some information about the Rice IT structure, what we've done with ITEL, where we hope to go next, because we're still what we think is at the beginning of our ITEL journey, what we've managed to accomplish, and a little bit of how we've done it. Rice University is a small school, 3,400 undergrads, 2,300 grads, about 650 full-time faculty, 400 part-time and adjunct faculty, a little over 2,000 staff members, about 115 acres, 74 buildings. Rice is 100 years old, and that is 100 years of culture of being a small research university. Many Rice alums are on among our faculty and staff, and so we have faculty and staff members who are Rice alums, who are sons and daughters of Rice alums. So they've never been anywhere other than Rice since high school. And that's an amazing aspect. Over 100 years, next few years, we'll probably be into third generation of those people. And that is a difficult culture to change because they have an awful long amount of time invested in the institution. Rice is place-based. There's no distance education. Our environment is what we call college-based. So if you're familiar with the English system of colleges, where when you come to a university, you are embroiled in a college, a collegial college, and that's where you stay for dorm activities, for residential activities, and the schools are the teaching institutions within the organization. So that's a little bit different. It's kind of like Hogwarts with Gryffindor and Slytherin. Okay? If you ask a Rice graduate where they graduated from, they're as likely to tell you Will Rice or Baker College as they are Rice University. There is more than a moderate resistance to change, and decision-making at Rice is very dispersed. So there's lots of shared governance activities at Rice, but within that, there are lots of other organizations that are much like IT. So there's an administrative services organization that handles our banner implementation. There are IT components embedded in many of the schools on campus. Decision-making is very diverse. Technology grew organically. And so we always have to find, okay, what's the root of this issue, because it's something that we don't even know about, because it grew up in another silo in another area. Lots of IT-like staffs on campus, and since Rice is about 100 years old, we sprung up in the Teddy Roosevelt days of rugged individualism, and believe me, that philosophy still predominates campus. Faculty look at themselves as individuals who are answerable to no one in a process of making decisions, deciding what needs to be done for them, and in the field, no two configurations are the same. Rice has absolutely no standards in terms of technology. So two offices side by side could be using two different kinds of computers, two different sets of software with entirely different configurations. Purchasing is distributed. Everybody can buy what they want on a P card. Nobody has to review it other than one over authority in the process of rights to purchase. And so we'd like to do things like put agents on the machines so that we can do remote support to machines. But people think that those agents are spying on them, and they have a great deal of distrust for what we might be watching them do on the machines. So from that kind of culture, one would anticipate that it would be very difficult to do idle. This is Rice's IT organizational chart hidden in the background. And you'll notice, like most everybody else, we're organized into silos. There's a silo for support. There's a silo for applications. There's a silo for networks and telecom. There's a silo for systems. There's a silo for business processes within IT. It is very difficult to work across the silos, even though most of us are in the same building and just down the hall from each other. That is the culture. That's why we've chosen to call our topic Against All Odds, because doing idle in the environment we've just described, we figure is against all odds. So in the quote from the movie from 1984, the tagline, best practices there is actually the word love, okay? But for us, best practices from idle, when we launched this, we thought could be nothing less than our lives. There was never any thought that we weren't going into an area where asking permission would be denied. So we went ahead and tried to do things on our own to try to make things and best practices take place. Barry, you're up next.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Good.
I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our idle processes, but I want to lay out a little groundwork first. The groundwork actually started in about 2004, so you'll get a little premise of what we went through. Around 2004, it was decided that our technology needed a refresh. The technology for networking and servers and systems and the data center had been deployed in 1992 and really hadn't been upgraded since then. So there was a large amount of change coming down the pike. We got very much embroiled in the change itself, and not in terms of managing the change. And so down the line, we needed something to manage that change. So IDLE is a framework. If you're not familiar with it, it's just a framework. It's not that prescriptive in terms of how you do things, but there are processes, and I would be willing to bet that most people in this room are probably following a lot of IDLE processes because they're all built around best practices. The framework just helps you to organize those best practices and put them to good use or better use. So we needed to pick some problem in around 2007. Nikki's going to talk about that, so I won't get into it. But in our venture through the reconstituting of the IT infrastructure at Rice, we changed out everything with the exception of the phone switch. Campus fiber, campus networking, electronics, servers. We built a data center. We did all of that at once. Now, I've never been in an institution where they've done everything at once. We've built a data center, we've rewired a building, we've done network upgrades, things of that nature, but I've been somewhere where we've tried everything at once. It was maddening. So we really needed that structure. So in terms of adopting IDLE, our process was let's pick the low-hanging fruit. And you can see that the potential to improve and the potential for change, our low-hanging fruit is our best option with our culture. So the change management piece was something that was really needed. As you saw in Gary's slide with regard to the IT structure and the campus structure as well, that we were a very siloed organization, and we needed something to tie things together. One of the main things that IDLE brought was the framework for communication across those lines. And so across those silos, we use the IDLE processes and change management to bring people together to talk about what's going on and how it impacts each other. Very little of that would go on beforehand. Everything was kind of confined within certain groups. So we started regular meetings, and those meetings still continue today. The meetings started in about 2005, 2006 time frame. They're three times a week. They're only 30 minutes, and they're very rigid in terms of their time frame. We don't want to spend a lot of time. They're very coordinated. The information that we go over, we only spend 30 minutes on. And I think people have found it very useful. And we have a cross-section across the institution. Anybody's invited to come. Anybody's invited to speak. We have some processes in place for submitting our change elements. And so those are going over first. And then people are allowed to ad hoc speak. And we have 3 days defined. Monday is PC bashing. Wednesday is Mac bashing, and Friday is open mic. So we created this change process, and we started out using the wiki to catalog and follow some of the agile processes for doing change management. But we looked at the framework, and we said some of these things don't really fit well with our culture and what we're doing, so we're going to change them a bit. IDLE was developed out of the UK, and so one of the specific changes that we had was they have two different types of change, a normal and a standard. Do you know the difference? Could you guess the difference by the name, normal, standard? We couldn't either. So we said, okay, we're going to have normal changes, we're going to have emergency changes, and we're going to have routine changes. So we changed some of the vocabulary. So that's the flexibility that IDLE brings that allows it to fit well within our culture and well within higher education, so we think. We also developed a change request form that provides a mechanism for people to give us the bare minimum amount of information needed to communicate what change is going to happen, how is it tested, who is it going to impact, things of that nature. The communication channel was, I think, the big win, because this was really all about communication. You can pretty it up and say, oh, we're following standards and we're doing best practices, but really what it brought to the table was that cross-institutional communication. It opened up a lot of communication channels and normalization and standardization of our information dissemination, and they designated a change manager. We also built a change management tool down the line, and you'll get to see a picture of that in just a minute. So here's the new change management tool. We took it out of the wiki. We said, this doesn't provide a critical piece or element that we really needed, and that was the history. So these are the elements that it does provide. So we have a calendar. People said, I want a calendar. I want to be able to look at a calendar and say what's happening on this day or what's happened the day before. It also is where we record our meeting notes and attendance. It's also a place where people can go and review the changes that are requested, that are coming down the pike, so they can see what's going on. It also provided us a collision planner, because this sprang up out of something with regard to the old network. The old network was very unstable, so people would try to plan things, piggyback them onto network events. That way, well, it's not my system, it's the network. So the network manager would always come in after the new network was deployed and say, he even had a T-shirt made up, it's not the network. So we have a searchable history now, so we can go back and see what happened before and how we did things before for review. We have the online change form where people can go online, they can submit their changes, they can identify all the characteristics of their change. And again, it forms a communication tool, because after each meeting, we post through email through the form out to everybody who subscribed. And we prescriptively send it to everybody within IT. Part of ITIL is defining metrics and figuring out, what you need to look at and how you need to monitor it. So our event monitoring was a little lax. When I first got there, we were using NetSaint, which became Nagios, and it was a little problematic in that it didn't provide us a distributed access. So everything kind of had to get funneled into a systems admin who had to do some magic to make the notifications and alerts work. We've since changed that, and you'll get to see a picture of that in just a minute. We needed to know when a service was down. We needed to know how we defined a system as being down. Was it because somebody called into the help desk? Was it because two people called into the help desk about a similar problem? So defining those things is very important. Figuring out how to calculate the metrics is another one. So if the network actually goes down, which it never does, it's not the network, remember. If the network were to go down and people can't get to their email, is mail down? So figuring out how to calculate those metrics is important. We implemented an event management tool. We built a reporting dashboard so everybody could see it. And again, this is part of the communication to the campus, to the people within IT, and understanding what's going on. And then evaluating and adjusting those expectations for the campus, because we build our services around the expectations of what the campus needs. And let me give you a little scenario. Let's say you go to a customer and they say, well, this service needs to be up 24/7 because it's just mission critical for me. And then, and you give them a worksheet that says, okay, here are all the things to make it 24/7. They say, oh my God, I can't afford that. So we have to lower their expectations because they can't afford the service that in 24/7. So they do it 8 to 5 and say it goes down after 5 one day. And they realize that, you know, that's just not going to work. And they come back and they say, well, this is just, you know, impossible. I need this after 5. So we go back and say, okay, well, this is what it's going to cost to do that. So the expectations change and we have to be flexible with that. So the reevaluation of those expectations is part of our cycle in the ITIL framework. And that's where we are today with our event management. So currently we use a tool called Zabbix. I'm not sure how many people are in here that are familiar with Zabbix. It's a monitoring tool. It's open source. It's built in Europe, and there's actually a company in France that will support it. One of the key things about Zabbix is that it provides a service-level view, and I think that's a very different thing from most monitoring systems. Most monitoring systems will tell you whether or not your disk drive is full, or if your network card is working, or if your CPU load is too high, or if you're running out of memory, or if your swap space is being used too heavily. This actually allows you to tie a lot of those things together and say, this service is not working. And so I don't have to have a systems admin tell a help desk manager or help desk operator that the service is down. They can go and look at this page. The other thing it brings to bear is that the systems administrators can drill down through this, and they can get a view of the service itself and identify very quickly the element that is causing the service to be down. So for the event management tool, we need things that can do trending over time, because we need a baseline. We need to know what, when we establish a service at a specific expectation, what does it look like? What are all our key parameters look like? Then we need to do things like traps when events occur. We need to poll the service for things for historical reasons. We need to check for dependencies and correlations, because a service is built out of many things. When you deliver a service, there could be redundancies that have to be in place, and there could be correlation with other services, such as networking and DNS, that have to be taken into consideration. Also, this provides us a view of data over time. Then we get to know what a service looks like from a systems perspective. That way, when an event occurs, we can detect it very easily and very early, hopefully, and we can prevent the service outage. Because in ITIL, the key element of ITIL is making sure that the service is delivered at the expectation of the customer. It's not whether the server's up. It's not whether the network's up. It's not whether there's power in the data center. If the customer can't get to the service, there's a problem. Part of my job is collecting the stats along the expectation and providing them to my boss as a measure of how well we're doing our job. Not me doing my job, but all of us doing our job. So here are some of the stats from this past year. We didn't make, last year we actually beat Google at our key performance indicators for email. This year we had a 2-hour outage, and that knocked us out of the park. So everything else we've been able to keep up fairly well. And meet the expectations, so that's a win for us. And we do it on an annual basis. Now, some of these services, and there's an error on the slide, the file services are actually redundant, or they have redundant pieces in them. We mirror the data. We have clustered servers. But some of them fail over automatically, and some of them require manual intervention. It just depends on what technology you can afford and what you choose. So this information is made available to our CIO or our vice provost for IT, and is as a metric for how well we're doing our job. And then he presents that to his boss, and on and on. I'm not expecting you to read this slide, but just know that we have an IT dashboard. Carlin, raise your hand. Carlin helped us put this together with the web services team. The dashboard allows the general public to look at any service and tell whether or not there's a problem or not. And they can click on an icon that says that there's a problem. It'll give them some information about what's going on, how long it's taking it to be fixed. And then the details of the notes are posted on the right-hand side in the outage information. So whenever we have an outage or some disruption of service, anybody on campus can go and look at this information, and it's available. Again, more communication is better. For the next steps, after the low-hanging fruit, is you got to know your organization. You need to know what the expectations are, because if you don't, then you can't meet them. You have to figure out your user perspectives of your organization and then understand what your users want, and then you have to deliver it. And for that, Nikki.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. So you've heard from the infrastructure person. Me and Gary were more on the support area. If you remember the silos in the very beginning, I come from the support area. And as you can imagine, we've already talked about, if you're familiar with ITIL, about different processes within ITIL. I am going to drill some more into processes that have to do with service operation, because that's where most of my life is spent. And also, having done all the adaptation and having taken all the steps to address the low-hanging fruit, we are now standing at RISE at the very pleasant position to actually be able to start really getting into service management. And one of the first things we've done is to distinguish between a request for service and an incident. How many of you are familiar with the ITIL distinction? Okay, everyone, good. So we've always had a ticketing system since forever at RISE. But that is not, having a ticketing system, something, you know, like Remedy or Heat or RT like we have, doesn't mean that you actually do incident management or that you actually do service management. So we have now started really, really trying to manage our services. The first thing we did was we created a service catalog, and I'm going to talk about it in a minute. And we have the help desk, which we want to call it service desk, actually, and it is the single point of contact for all the customers to get help from any about any of the services we offer. And it took a lot of work, and a lot of people got involved from the support area, and we designed a process workflow for each one of the services we offer. Now, some points that you may be wondering about. When you say every service that you offer, what exactly do you mean? Well, all right. The services that we actually deliver. Example is one service that we don't offer. We have IT does not do the PeopleSoft side of RISE. There's another department that does it, right? So we didn't include in this work yet that service. Even though it's an IT-like service, it is not something we offer. So all the services that we own and that we're responsible for, we sat down and we described them, we defined them. And I'll talk about this in a little while, we actually had to involve people from the field, people from infrastructure, as we're talking about this workflows and process definitions. We have a service manager, and we would like to actually have a tool that does all of these things automatically. But let me go a thing at a time and talk first about the service catalog. Well, so that you are not wondering, this is the service catalog. This is 33 pages, including the appendices. So it's not a lot. I mean, don't think of a huge, thick binder, right? And what does the service catalog say? Here is an example. It defines all of our services, and it distinguishes between critical, standard, extended, and not supported. Standard services is something that everybody in the RISE community is entitled to. critical services are the subset of those services that have to be up 24/7, 360. Extended services are services that we would be technically able to offer, but we can't really afford to offer it as a standard service, so we may want to charge people to do it. And not supported are services that some department or faculty member wants to buy from a third-party vendor, and obviously we cannot support, we cannot help at all with that service. For each one of our services, we have the following fields: the overview, description, what it is, the audience, who gets that service, who is entitled to that service, the availability. So what's the expectation? What is the uptime? What is the deliverables? Things like that. And I can read you some of the services just for just as an example. What you have up there, you see the definition for the service desk. We have a help desk. Who is the audience? Well, the entire US community. What is the availability? Well, 9 to 5 or whatever it is. You have to define all those things. Other examples of let's look at, for example, the critical service. Mail or storage is one of our critical services. Authentication services. The overview says IT maintains a central authentication service. The audience is the entire RISE community. Everybody who is affiliated with RISE will get a password and an ID, a single sign-on. The availability should be 24/7, 365. And then the specification, go and say more things that make are meaningful to us. But in general, if you look at this document, and it is under our VPIT section of our website, it is also attached as a resource to this presentation, you will see that this is a document that the customers could read and understand what they can expect from us. Then, if you look at all the services that are defined there, and then you look at this other document that we created, and it's not very thick either. It's about 20 pages. So this document contains all the workflows of the services, just like the one you see up there. Now, this 20 pages took a long time to create. What we did is we took people, as I said, from the field, people from infrastructure. We sat down and we thought about every one of the requests for service. And again, we're talking about requests for service. Request for service is something that you know how to deliver. It's not an incident. It is something that you have a clear way of providing. You know ahead how to do it ahead of time, and you know how long it should take for you to provide that service. So we defined the workflow. We identified who does what. If you look at the different colors on this workflow, usually signify other entities or different silos within the organization. And one way to think about it is the life of a ticket. If you have a request for service, a ticket that creates a request for service, it would more or less travel through a workflow until the service has been provisioned, has been provided to the customer. Now, we found out that it was very important to define the inputs. So when somebody requests something, we really need to know all the information from the customer that's needed to fulfill that service, right? So how many of you have gotten tickets where the customer says, I want A, and they don't tell you, you know, what their this is, what, you know, they don't tell you enough information. Do you have a PC or a Mac? Do you have I want MATLAB installed. Where are you? Do you want it on your PC? Do you want it on your laptop? They don't tell you all these things. So we tried and sat down and wrote down the inputs that are required for us to know ahead of time so that we can quickly fulfill that service instead of going back to the customer and asking, oh, you didn't tell us that or you didn't tell us this. These inputs are also important as we pass tickets to other
I'm not going to call them silos because they're not silos anymore, but to other teams in the organization that need to do work to fulfill the service. And they may be the initial input from the customer plus other input that the help desk staff or other service desk staff have added to pass. This is, as you may know, a great point of friction and conflict within organizations. Well, you didn't give me enough, so I'm going to send you back the ticket, and the customer, there is delay, and so on and so forth. So, and we also have defined the outputs, which means by the end of this ticket, when I get it back from my infrastructure team, I know I will have these deliverables ready. In theory, and we're still, this is still a work in progress, but in theory, this way you should know whether you should have defined ahead of time what is the time expectation for fulfillment for a service, and you should know from each one, from on each case of request whether you've met that metric that you have put to yourself. So in essence, you having defined the workflow, having defined the process, also takes into account the expectation for fulfillment for the customer, and also gives you a measure to see if you meet that expectation. So the next step is problem management, and this is a horrible picture of me, and it's staged. This does not really happen, but you all have seen, and somebody was telling me about this the other day, when you have a problem, which means something that causes one or more incidents, and you're not you're not sure of the root cause of it, how do you resolve this? And it's a very common phenomenon, yet you have to go from team to team to team and see, okay, do a round robin around different places or different teams of the organization, say, is it the network? Is it the system? Is it this? Is it that? So this is my stage of over. Are you guys? Is it you guys? Don't tell me it's not you guys. That's supposed to be the picture. But we don't have to do that anymore. What we do is we used our incident management, our ticketing system, and we created problem tickets, problem records. So instead of having the same old fields that an incident has, we have added fields that are just as they are defined in ITIL. So, for example, we have defined who is the team, not the person, not the agent, but who is the team that owns the problem record at each time. And if they examine it and they find that it's really nothing they can do, they can write down the research, what they've done, and then pass it to someone else. And we have designated a problem manager who is responsible for overlooking all these problems. We have a separate queue for problems. And they are responsible for making sure they are eventually resolved. And, you know, if you think of problems as major crises, then, of course, they're going to be resolved. You know, if your mail server is down, yes, everybody's going to react very eagerly and very urgently to it. But there are other problems that may be nagging and you know, creating friction and creating bad will among customers that previously, before doing problem management, we could not raise and identify. We would create little incidents for this user and that user and that user, and people at the service desk were aware that this is a problem. In fact, the infrastructure team would have told them, yeah, we know this is a problem. We don't know what's causing this. Something in the image, let's say, for example. So what we do now, we say, okay, something in the image is causing this problem. We create a ticket, and the problem manager is responsible to assign it from team to team to team until it gets resolved, and then all the associated incidents can also get resolved. So we are, again, making quite a bit of progress in this one. And then it's funny that we return back to incident management, which I said we have always been doing, but we are actually, we were just responding to incidents. We're not really managing. So what we want to do for incidents is the same thing that we did for a request for service. So we have all these workflows now, right? the workflow that says printing. How do I provision a new printer? Well, what I want to do is I have also a workflow that says, what do I do when I have problems, when I have incidents with printing, like my printer stopped working? What happens then? And it will probably be similar to that, because this workflow contains who gets the ticket, how it gets escalated, but it's not the same, because remember, for a service, I know what's happening, I know every step of the way, but an incident, I really don't know. It's more open. So we're working to do that now. And let me see. Yes. Also, once we have this incident management working, we're hoping to have also real-time metrics. Right now, most of our metrics are post-mortem, I call them. Like, okay, how many tickets did we have last month or last year? We have an open source tool that actually allows us to do quite a bit of real-time dashboarding on metrics, but we need to have the incident management workflows in place so that we can put inside those workflows the crucial points where we measure, so we get a better picture and an automated picture. Some other things that I wanted to go over. All of these documents that I showed you, they are attached to the resources of the paper. And finally, the next steps, configuration management. We kind of have a CMDB, because the Zabbix tool that we have, in a great extent, plays the role of a CMDB. But we don't have a thorough asset management. Remember, we don't have central procurement. We don't have central purchasing. So not every one of our assets is in a database somewhere. But that is not that crucial to us, because the big items, our servers, they are in Zabbix. So in a sense, we have a little bit of a CMDB, but not quite what you would expect if you're at the idle framework. We want to have better tools to help us work with our service request flows and with our incident management flows. So what we are doing right now slowly is we're trying to create self-service forms. So if you have a request for service, the customer can go and answer. Remember how I talked about inputs? For each request for service, you need to have certain inputs. So if you have an automated page, you can ask the customer to provide all those inputs. If you have an online form, for example. We need to continue to manage this. And the way we did this, in case you're wondering, we have the IT advisory committee, which is made up of a lot of important faculty members and of IT management, and they were the ones who discussed and decided about the service catalog, and they are the ones who are supposed to revise it at the beginning of each semester. And if you're wondering whether the customers do know about the service, is anybody wondering if the customers know and respect this and care about this? Be honest. They are, actually. It works in many ways. For example, the very important faculty members, the all self-important faculty members that have the big item requests, they are very aware of that, because they work closely with the ITAC committee, and they are aware of, remember extended services? So if this is not a standard service, they may be requested to help us with resources, things like that. But it also works in small ways. For example, I have posted in the help desk parts of this that say, for example, retirees are not allowed to use the student shop to have their computers disinfected. This is much more, so it really helps you. It actually does work. And I have parts of it posted in posters. And then we cannot be strong-armed, because I know it happens to everyone, where people come and say, you IT can technically, you have the ability to do this for me, please do it. Well, not really, because you're not in the audience of this service. You know, I have a repair shop for students, but you as a retiree, you're not, you're a RISE community member, you can keep your single sign on, but you can, you're not entitled, according to this, to get service from my student repair shop. So it really does work in big and small ways. And then we hope to get more work done on asset management, knowledge management. We are somehow doing a little bit. We have a great website and a wiki to help us, but we want to integrate it with our incident management tool, and then continued improvement. Oh, and this is a little thing. For those who are in a rush to adopt ITIL, this shows you, I was keeping a journal. This is it. The top pages are copies from this little book. And every time we took a step, either in view of, as in training or adopting a one of the ITIL processes, I would put it in my timeline. And it starts from 2007 and goes all the way now to now. And that doesn't include the pre-steps that Barry talked about and that happened already, that were happening in 2005. So I'll give it back to Gary now.
So some outcomes. How has ITIL changed RISE? Well, one of the things it's done is we do an annual survey of satisfaction among faculty, staff, and students with our services. We've seen some increase in satisfaction over the time that we've been implementing ITIL. Now, if you're really wise, you'll look at and see that faculty haven't increased. Students have, both graduate and undergraduate and staff, but not faculty. Faculty are the ones that have the long-term perspective at RISE, and probably at your institutions too. To them, ITIL has just been a blip on the radar at the moment. They're waiting to see what the systemic change has been rather than something that has occurred over just a couple of years. How has ITIL changed RISE? Well, those silos are now breaking down. Cross-functional teams work much more closely together than in the past. So this identifies the teams for change, event, service, problem, and incident, the things that we've tackled so far out of the process. And you see the colors scatter over the entire organizational chart. We've been brought together to work differently than we have before. So here's another example of how ITIL has changed RISE. We were doing a service discontinuance as part of our service lifecycle. We were doing something, taking away a service that 1,055 faculty had been using. So we used a process by sending letters to them and email reminders, asking them a survey. Here are six things that you can do to migrate your service. Which one do you want us to do? We had a 99.34% response rate from faculty. If you can get that kind of a response rate from your faculty on any kind of survey, better than that, come work for me. The interesting aspect of that is that 17% who didn't have to write anything on this other than check which of the six things they were going to take, wrote back, and the number one comment was, thanks for asking. How have we done all of this with ITIL? Well, no one approved it. There was no top-down approach. There was no plan. There was no committee. There was no campus support. And there were no consultants involved. There was a little bit of vocabulary, because you've got to learn an incident, a service, a problem, and a little bit of what those mean. Although we didn't bite off the entire ITIL vocabulary, we changed it, as Barry described earlier, to our purposes. There was no pressure. No one came to someone and said, you are going to do ITIL tomorrow. There was absolutely no executive involvement. We didn't even consult with a VP CIO when we did it. We just did it. No money. No disruption. And very little training. So the three of us and managers within most of the components have been trained in ITIL foundations. No one has pressed further toward the expert level than that process. And the average rank-and-file member doesn't know ITIL. They just know, here's my job and how I fit into those workflows and what I'm expected to do. There was a lot of slow organizational change. Changing our organization is difficult. It's going to take a lot more slow change to make it happen. There was a lot of searching for practical implementations. ITIL training teaches you how to do this in business and industry. It doesn't teach you how to do it in higher education. So we had to spend a lot of time looking for people like what we're doing here today to share with us ideas of how they made things happen within a higher education environment. Lots of communication. The number one thing we discovered we weren't doing well as an IT organization was communicating with our users. So a lot of the things you've heard so far have been elements of communication. A lot of thought. IDLE, as you've been told, isn't a prescriptive method of doing anything, but it makes you step back and think about everything that you do. So the reflection that IDLE has brought has helped us. Getting that business speak out of IDLE was something we had to do, and we did a lot of work in trial and error. We would try something that we thought would make things better, see if it did, see if it didn't, and then make adjustments to the process. Thanks. Questions? Comments? Concerns?
What tool do you use for the tickets?
We use a tool called RT, which is an open source. RT stands for Request Tracker. It runs in a Linux environment. And removing that tool and moving to something that implements workflows, which it does not do, is one of the important things that we need to do as a next step for us.
What is that tool that you are planning to?
There are several tools that have IDLE compliance to it. Remedy Heat, Alteris, all of those service desk implementations allow IDLE processes to be built within. Okay, I think we're kind of leaning in the favor of the Alteris tool set from Symantec, but any of the others will work just as well. BMC is an excellent tool.
Oh, we had. Can I answer that?
Okay.
Yeah. Whether we had the tools before. So what, we had RT before, and we closed RT. At first, we were using RT for change management. We were logging our change requests in RT. Eventually, we built a homegrown product, the one that you saw the screenshot. Oh, thank you. So we had RT at first. We used RT first for incidents. We used it for change management. Then we built the little a homegrown product for change management that does the calendar view. And I'm not sure if this is available. We'll ask internally if we can give it to the world. Then we had Zabbix, which we didn't have before. We're using Nagios. And now we're using a still RT for problem management. We just created a different type of ticket that is a problem ticket. And, you know, all of the tools, you can use any tool to do that. All you need to do is bind one ticket to many and be able to add fields. In fact, the one thing, if you're looking for a tool, the one thing that's important is the ability to configure the tool. If one of our processes changes or if we add a new service, you have to think about whether you have to pay a consultant or you can do your own configuration if you want to change something in your fields or in your queues or in your whatever. So that's a concern.
So piecemeal, we looked at doing tools, sometimes building, sometimes creating, sometimes repurposing for what piece of the process that we wanted to do. So we didn't go out and buy a tool that was going to help us make IDLE better. Yes? Actually, it's been presented on in previous EDUCAUSES, and we have a proposal in to present on it next year. The communication plan is many and varied. We have chosen a bunch of different targeted communication processes to accomplish each piece of that. So there's something called IT alerts that alerts when a service goes down. There's something called IT heads up that we send internally to let people know that a problem has been smelled on campus. All of the stuff we do is in wikis and in a website. So the service catalog, our processes are available to you to look as links off of resources that are there. So many and varied, but hopefully EDUCAUSE will have us back to spend time on just communication again next time around. And Carlin, my communication officer, is in the audience here today. That is the change advisory board, exactly. Wow. We have not called it a change advisory board. We just call it a change meeting because we want to invite anybody who wants to talk about a change to be present.
So you just talk about, we are going to do this change.
It's a little more formal than that, but yes, you can consider our change meeting part of our change advisory board processes. I'll be happy to talk to y'all about that afterwards if you want details.
So we need to cut it off so you can head off to the main speaker. We'll stick around for a little bit so you can ask us questions. Thanks for coming.